Jewish community and the Orthodox community in particular is the growing instability of marriages coupled with the apparent increase in non-marriages. Certainly there is a large number of Orthodox singles that seem to be clustered in certain sections. We're witnessing it in the neighborhood that I live in, New York, in Washington Heights, as a very recent phenomenon. And a Torah perspective, an analysis of where we're at, and some approaches to deal with the situation is what we intend to discuss in this particular session. I've used up my entire time as moderator. There are two excellent panelists. It's a unique opportunity for me because I get first to introduce my wife. Dr. Rivka Blau, whom some of you have heard already this morning in an earlier session, is a prominent Jewish educator, writer, and lecturer. She's the author of a biography of her father, Learn Torah, Love Torah, Live Torah, about the late beloved Rav Pinchas Mordechai Teitz Zatzal, and spent 20 years as a principal in girl yeshiva high schools, and certainly is an excellent and articulate speaker and very perceptive in her understanding of the needs of the community. Dr. Rivka Blau.
A friend of mine told me about her daughter, who had gone out with many different young men. In fact, when she added up, she figured out it must have been 60 young men that she had gone out with, and nothing had happened. No spark had been struck, no revelation had happened that this is the one. She was really becoming concerned. And then she went out with a young man, and they had instant understanding between them. They just spoke the same language, they understood each other's jokes, they felt so comfortable with each other, they had the same ideals, they had the same ideas about many different things, and it just seemed wonderful. There was one problem. This was the first time that he had ever gone out. So he felt that she had a basis for comparison and contrast, but he didn't know what he was doing. And maybe it's because it was the first time that he had ever gone out that he was so enamored of her. So he went to his Rosh Hashiva, who was Rav Pam, a Torah Vadas, and he asked, what should I do? She knows what she's doing. I think I know what I'm doing, but I can't be sure. And Rav Pam said, well, there are two approaches you can take. One approach is, what a favor Hashem did me. I don't have to go through, does she want to, does she not want to, is she interested, is she not interested? Right away, we each understand that we like each other so much. And the other approach is, no, you don't know what you're doing. You're a novice, and you have to at least have some basis of comparison and contrast before you go ahead. The young man said to Rav Pam, so which approach should I take? Rav Pam said, that you have to decide. And that's what life is all about. We can go for consultation, we can go to get recommendations, we can go for advice, but ultimately, we have to decide for ourselves. A little louder? Okay. I'll move forward. Okay. this better? I'll hold it. That's the best way. Okay. Okay. And when you think about it, whoops. Okay. This is just like a marriage. You have difficulty getting started, and then you get things underway. Okay. Okay. I had just mentioned a story about Rav Pam, the Rosh Yeshiva Torah Vadas, telling a young man he had to make a decision by himself when he had a question about whether to marry a young woman. He was going out for the first time. She had gone out many times. And Rav Pam said, ultimately, it's a decision that you have to make yourself. When you think about it, in the Torah, we have two very different models, very close to each other, for how to find a wife. One model is Yitzchak with Rivka, where instructions are given to Eliezer to go and look for a specific kind of person. Certain qualities are being looked for. And Rivka is brought back to Yitzchak. They see each other for the first time when they're actually already committed to each other, betrothed to each other. And it's after he brings her to the ohel of Sarah Imo, after he brings her to the tent of his mother Sarah, then Vaye'e Haveha. Then he first loved her. They were already underway in the relationship. Then love followed, and then followed the marriage. We have a very different model with Yaakov, who sees Rachel when all the shepherds are coming to the Be'er, coming to the well, and who very quickly understands this is the woman that he wants to marry, and he agrees to work for Laban for 7 years, which seemed like a moment because he cared for Rachel so deeply, because he loved Rachel so much. So we seem to have two models here. One model of check out the qualities carefully, have someone else do the scouting for you, have someone else do the checking for you. And another model of people see each other, reach an understanding very quickly, and care for each other. And I think the Torah is giving us a very important message here, that there is not one single way to find a mate, that there is not one prescription that fits all, and that there are many different ways that one might be introduced to the person one is going to marry. Sometimes you see the other person as part of a group, and that person stands out from the group. That's how Yaakov saw Rachel. Sometimes the person is checked out for you. That's how Yitzchak met Rivka, and many other possible models as well. I think what's going on right now is that we have taken a system that we think used to work in Europe, and we are trying to apply it in a very different society, in a very different social milieu, and unfortunately, it's not working. And I'm not sure it worked perfectly in Europe either, because Professor Shaul Stemper at Hebrew University went back to Eastern Europe, went to Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, other areas, and checked through the records from a century ago, the birth records, the marriage records, the divorce records, all these kinds of records, actually checking what the numbers were. We're under the impression that it was a very peaceful period in Europe, where there was very little divorce. And yet, Dr. Stemper found that as many as one-third of the marriages ended in divorce. And he discovered what was going on. I was shocked by this. I said, are you sure? I mean, I knew about this particular Gadol that his second wife had divorced her first husband because he turned out to be a businessman, and she wanted to marry a Talmid Chacham. And then when she remarried, she wanted to remarry to a Talmid Chacham. And I knew that Sarah Schneer, the founder of the Beis Yaakov movement, had been unhappy in her first marriage. She and her husband had been divorced, and it was in her happy marriage to the second husband that she founded the Beis Yaakov movement. So I knew isolated things about great figures who had divorced. Obviously, it was not considered any kind of stigma or any kind of mark against their historical greatness. But I didn't know that for the Jewish population, there had been a fairly steep rate of divorce. I said, Professor Stemper, how do you explain this? And how do you explain that we don't know about this? It's only 100 years ago that you were the records that you were investigating, and how do we not know this? He said he thinks that a number of the marriages that were contracted when the people were very young, and when they grew up a little bit and discovered they were not compatible, they were not meant for each other, he thinks that there was very little stigma attached at that time to divorce. That there was an understanding, if it's not working, so end this particular relationship and go into a relationship that will bring you happiness. go into a relationship that will work. So what we're trying to do, we have forgotten about the fact that there were divorces under that system where people were introduced by someone, and we have forgotten what it was like to live in a closed society. And now we're in an open society where young people are very often living quite far away from their families, and we are expecting them somehow to get introduced by a magical someone to the person who will be their mate, and we're sort of expecting it to happen by itself. And we tell them two terrible things when it's not working. The first thing we tell them is, do your hishtadlus, which means make an effort. What effort exactly is a young woman supposed to make who's living in Flatbush, let's say, or living in Washington Heights, which has now become a center for young singles, or living in Kew Garden Hills, and whose family is away in Toronto or Los Angeles or wherever else it might be? What exactly is she supposed to do in the way of hishtadlus to meet someone? Hishtadlus means make an effort, make an endeavor. What are you telling her when you tell her a thing like that? The other thing that young people get told is you must be too picky. That's the problem. You're just holding up too high standards. That's why it's not happening. Again, that's not fair. I have had girls who went to Stern College who have come to tell me that in 4 years at Stern College, they never had a date. So how can anybody tell them they're too picky? There haven't been any pickings. There hasn't been anything from which to make a choice. And I, of course, am very aware of it because my husband, in his position as Mashgiach Ruchni at Yeshiva, often gets phone calls from parents of daughters who say, do something about it. Introduce our daughters. And he feels that he cannot compromise his position as the director of religious guidance at Yeshiva by having the boys feel that every time he walks over to them in the study hall in the Beit Midrash, he's only coming because Mrs. X or Mr. X was anxious about a daughter, and therefore he's proposing a date. That's not the way that you're going to see to it that people get married. I think we have to think about it in a much larger way. We are not the close-knit society of Europe. We have many young people living quite far away from their families, just at the age when they should be meeting somebody to marry. And we are relying on a system that is no system and that doesn't work. I think we have to also consider how young people feel and why certain things are happening. Now, this is anecdotal. I don't have statistics, but I do see it happening, and I am aware of it because we're right at the center, at the eye of the storm. First of all, a number of engagements are breaking. And I think engagements are breaking for a few reasons. One is that people are rightfully frightened of marriage because they take a look at married couples that they see who have not reached the point of happiness that they would like, and they wonder, is this what it's going to be all about? Another is that people don't really know each other when they get engaged, since we now have such an artificial system of if by 5 dates it's already serious and by 6 dates you're practically married. So that means that they don't really know each other and they're already engaged. Then they first start finding out about each other, which is why the engagements break, because they are now learning things that they really should have known earlier before getting caught in any kind of agreement. And the last thing is that sometimes people are pushed into engagement much too young. Because the parents are so afraid of a daughter getting caught at 25 and not being married yet, and because the parents are so afraid that for a boy this will go on, and who knows what kind of arrangement or what kind of liaison he'll get caught in, so parents talk kids into early marriages, but even during that early engagement, sometimes the young man and the young woman realize this is not a good thing. In fact, I have a friend who had two interesting comments to make. One was when we were mentioning the fact that an 18-year-old young woman and a 19-year-old young man were getting married, she said, well, I guess that their gift registry is going to be at Toys R Us. These are kids. And then in another case where a young couple is doing a very unusual thing and having a year-long engagement, and I said to her, well, what will I get them for an engagement gift? They invited us to the time, but the wedding's not going to be for another year, which is unusual in religious circles. And she said, well, get them a savings bond. By the time it matures, they'll be getting married. So either way, engagements are breaking, unfortunately. And it is because people did not know each other and are afraid to get committed into a marriage. Something else is happening that's making marriage very difficult. And that is that the surrounding society has created a great deal of pressure and different kinds of questions to which nobody has an answer yet. First of all, if you go to a yeshiva high school, you have one set of expectations in yeshiva high school about what your relationship should be between young men and young women. Another set of expectations when they're in Israel. Another set of expectations when they're in college. And yet another set of expectations when they go into the working place. And I know that for many young people, the adjustment to the workplace is a very surprising one, a very befuddling one. Among other things, the language in the average workplace today is a far cry from any kind of clean language or any kind of appropriate communication between people. And a young man or young woman who has been in a yeshiva surrounding for most of his or her life can really be taken aback by the very low and coarse nature of what passes for discussion in the workplace today. Some of them will already have found it in university with a president, with a professor trying to prove how au courant he is and how in style he is by also using very foul language. But there's also a whole set of expectations about what the relationship will be between men and women that is very, very different today. And it's just assumed that we're back to a very primitive society where anything goes and do anything you please. And here's a young person coming from such a, in a sense, pure environment and coming into something so much the opposite, it's quite an adjustment. At the same time that the people are making this adjustment, there's a whole new relationship in marriage that's going on today. Anyone who has grandchildren who are below the age of 10 knows that it's very different from when those of us who are the grandparents were raising our children. It's assumed that it's a partnership between husband and wife, both in terms of earning the living that will keep the family going, and in terms of parenting the children. And the society's assumption is that a father is just as adept at changing a diaper as a mother, and that the father can take care of the children. It's not called babysitting when the father does it. It's called parenting. And that the father can take care of the children just as well as the mother can. At the same time, the mother is very often also working at another job besides the most important job of caring for her family. So this creates a whole new set of pressures for the young people contemplating marriage. And when people are getting one set of messages from their schools, for example, that it's important to spend a number of years learning Torah before you start earning a living, or that the highest form of existence is learning Torah and anything else is a cut below it, instead of getting a more real and practical message about what it takes to earn a living for a family and what it takes to support a family, I am not against in any way anybody learning. My husband and I, Baruch Hashem, have sons who are all mechanchim, so obviously money was not the major consideration of the family's choice of career. They're each teaching Gemara. They're each very, very involved in Torah life, very involved in learning, but each one was aware of the fact that he could not expect his wife to be the one who was going to carry the burden of supporting the family, that it has to be a partnership. So at the same time that they're busy navigating all the different societies that they have to navigate and all the shocks to their systems they're getting from this big, new, primitive world that we're living in now, at the same time, we're asking them to operate with a very old-fashioned system that, as I say, I'm not sure worked so well, even when it was being used in a closed society in Europe. I think we have to take the burden off our young people. I was very saddened when a young woman who had gone to the high school that I headed, who's only 23 years old, Leah Inhara, told me that she gets up every morning, and after she says Moda Ani, she thinks to herself, and I'm not married yet. Imagine, she gets up every day, and that's her before Birchas HaTorah, before Birchas HaShachar, after Moda Ani comes, and I'm not married yet. This is a tremendous pressure and a tremendous burden for young people to bear. And I think what we have to do, we must provide ways for young people to meet. This is something that the whole community has to do. And it's not just going to happen through having shidduch clubs meet where people talk about this one and that one and try to put people together. I have found that very few matches result from that. What we have to do is think about ways of making venues. We have to make arenas of introduction for people. For example, a member of the community in Washington Heights where we live told me that the Aguda in Washington Heights for many years used to have shalashuddis purposely arranging for young men to sit on one side of the table, young women to sit on the other side of the table, And he said many shidduchim came out of those shalosh shudas arrangements. He says it was so easy. Everybody davened mincha. Everybody went downstairs for shalosh shudas. There was a Devar Torah at the shalosh shudas. And it wasn't just for the young people. It was a number of people were there. But it was understood that the young men sat on this side of the table, the young women on that side of the table. And he said there are many happy marriages, thank God, in the Washington Heights community that came out of getting to know each other at the shalosh shudas. Because it wasn't artificial, and it wasn't rushed, and it wasn't an 8-minute speed date where you have 8 minutes to figure out if you want to spend the rest of your life with this person or not, which is a little bit pressured. Instead, it was gradually over a whole year of Shabbos afternoons, getting to know another person, getting to see how that person interacts with other people, and being able to figure out, might this be a possibility, and then starting to go out together. I think we have to think about creating shiurim. I just heard about a young man in our building who's a Baal Tshuva, and who was having difficulty getting to meet people and to know people. He arranged for a class in Sefer HaChinuch in his apartment, given by the rabbi who first helped him become observant. And they have about 8 young men and 8 young women coming every Tuesday night. I mean, it's not quite every Tuesday night. They started with Parshas Bereishis, so they're just getting underway. But they're going to be getting together every Tuesday night for an hour to study Sefer HaChinuch together. And afterward, they're going to be having some refreshments, some chatting together, so that a group of people can get to know each other and can get to know something about each other. If you're going to do these kinds of classes, I think you have to think of a lot of different kinds of scheduling. Some things can be done every week. Some things can be done in a 4-week course. Some things can be done as a very special large evening with a very special speaker of some kind. We have to think about a lot of different ways. We can have musical evenings where people can come together to listen to music in one way or another, and again, refreshments afterward for people to talk to each other. We can have Shabbos and Yom Tov meals at a shul where we specifically make it for young, single people. And my husband and I once participated in this about 10 years ago, and it's something that has to be revived in our neighborhood, and I hope it's about to be revived. What they did was to have everybody sit as they pleased for the meal. And that ended up being about half young men, about half young women at each table, although some tables were all young men and some tables were all young women. It was just however people sat down, random seating. They had benching after the main course. Then they went into another room to have a talk on something that was lending itself to people's discussion. That particular talk was the future of the Orthodox Jewish community. Everybody can have opinions about that. And it's a way for people to interact if they've heard a talk about it. Then they came back into the original room to have tea and cake and time for people to chat with each other in a very informal way. And I thought this was such a beautiful way to do things. It gave people a means of getting to meet a little bit just at random, getting to hear a talk, and even from the questions that people ask after the talk, even from the comments that people make after the talk, you can get to know something about another person. And then you have what to start the conversation with afterward. Because I have just learned a new term that I had never known before. It's called to be Georged. And what the young people mean by that is somebody who asks you so many questions, it's like being on George Foreman's grill. So it's called to be Georged. And it means that there's not a real conversation taking place between the people. There's not a real interchange of personality and character going on. No, it's what does your father do? What does your mother do? What did your grandmother, where did your grandmother... What kind of thing is this? This is not real conversation, and this is not really getting to know each other. In fact, a friend of mine, whose daughter is at the stage of going out now, said her daughter sometimes wonders, is this a date or is this a prubba? Is this an interview for a position that she's going through? And there's a group called End the Madness. I don't agree with all their tactics, even though I did speak for them once, but they made a shirt, which I got when I spoke for them, saying there is such a thing as a stupid question. And you'll see the questions afterward. Many of the questions really are intelligent. Questions like, what school did she study in? These kinds of questions, would she like to settle in Israel? These are relevant things to know. Not that it has to be that you will not go out with somebody who will not settle in Israel. You can't make a geographic decision before you make a personal decision. But some of them really are kind of offensive questions about relatives. Does anybody have such a clean bill of health? They can assure that no relative ever died. I mean, what are we asking for when we're asking for proof that this will be a proper shidduch? You'll see, and you'll evaluate yourself what you think about these questions afterward. But it does say a great deal that a group has to be formed to say, enough already, how many questions are we going to ask? We have to use weddings as a good way for people to meet. Where is there, and everything surrounding the wedding as a good way for people to meet? Where do you have a more select group than the friends of the bride, of the kala, and the friends of the groom, of the chasan? You couldn't have a better group of young people coming together. Let's stop worrying about genealogy and all the rest of it. This is already a wonderful group if they're friendly with this chasan kala. So what we should be doing is, at the vart, at the l'chaim, at the sheva brachos, but especially at the wedding, we should be providing means for people to talk to each other. I have gone to a vart where there actually was a sign saying, women to this side. Now, there were two things wrong with that. First of all, if they want to say that men and women should separate, there should also have been a sign saying, men to this side. I mean, it's not just the women who have to get out of the way. That's one thing that I found a little offensive about the sign. But also, how are young people supposed to meet each other if they can't even cross over the line in the middle of the room to talk to each other? And again, when I looked around at that room, and I thought, every young woman here, the bride had gone to my school, and I knew every young woman in that room. One was nicer and finer and more able and more refined than the other. And I looked at the young men, and I knew who the young man was that she was engaged to, and each one, again, a gem. Why should these two groups of people not be talking to each other at a vart of all things, which is you're going to reach only if they will have a chance to talk to each other? And, of course, at a wedding, I know that we have adopted the Hungarian custom of separate seating at weddings since 1956. But I think since the Hungarian Revolution, which brought a lot of Hungarians to Canada and the United States, but I think we really have to think through whether the Litvish custom was not a good custom. Because the understanding was, at a wedding in Lithuania or Latvia, that the best thing that could result from that wedding was another wedding. And what they used to do was to have tables that were rectangular, because circular tables, you can't really carry on a good conversation across the circle. A rectangular table, you can carry on a good conversation. They had place cards for men on one side, for the women on the other, and the chasan kala were expected to think through who should meet whom and place them opposite each other at the wedding. And in fact, at my husband's and my wedding, not only did we do that because my father recommended to us that we should do it, but I have a friend who wanted to meet a particular young man. She saw that I had the place cards, and I had put her three seats away. She came to me after the wedding. She said, Rivka, I hope you don't mind, but I switched the place cards because I really wanted to talk to him. But what a nice way to meet. What a beautiful way to meet. And you already have a select group there. I have to tell you that I am really, in a certain sense, whistling in the wind when I say this, because to get young people to come to this will be a separate effort. Many of them are getting the message, while they're in Israel or elsewhere, that you can't meet in a group setting. And I cannot say that I fault them for that, because I was under the same impression. My husband and I were both active in a group called Yavne. In fact, I was one of the founders. It was a religious college students organization. And I was the one who was adamant at 18 that it should have nothing social in it. It should be for shiurim. It should be for kiruv. It should be for kosher food on campus and no exams on Shabbos. But it should absolutely not be social. It won't work if it's social. And, of course, it was at a Yavne shir that I met my husband and that three other couples met at the same shir. So let's try to help the young people get over this idea that it shouldn't be social and that you're not allowed to meet when it's groups that are meeting together. And we also have to talk to the people who are teaching them this. I know of somebody who wanted to organize a brunch once every month. She could get the young women together, and would I get the young men together? And there would be a short shir. And when I went to two young men at Yeshiva University, they both said, well, in Israel, we heard that that's not an appropriate thing to do. So they did not want to meet. I said, but the group will be hand-picked. It's not going to be just anybody coming to it. So we have to change that mentality. I think we have to make Shabbos meals at our own homes, where we invite young people, young men and young women, to meet in a very nice atmosphere. We can have debates where there are discussions afterward. There's no limit to the number of things that we can do. But the most important thing is we have to let the young people know we understand what they're going through. We're not putting it off on them. We're not saying, do your hishtadlus or you're being too picky. We're trying to think of ways for young men and young women to meet each other. And one of the most important things we can do, and that's why it's so perfect that I'm preceding Rabbi Volka, is to have good marriages. They see marriage is a good thing to get into, and not to feel that it's something terrible. Just close with one last little funny thing. A friend of ours was so pleased when his daughter told him, "Abba, when I marry, I want to marry a man just like you." And he said he felt so good. And then she said, "The new improved model."
For a male rabbinic perspective, I'd like my pleasure and honor to introduce Rabbi Dr. Reuven Volka, who is a Rav in Ottawa, Canada, and a psychologist, the author of 34 books, and my time allotted to me does not permit me to mention the titles of the books. Rabbi Volka.
All right, can you hear me? Good. Yasher Koyach. Firstly, a point of personal privilege. There's more than just mere coincidence in me following Rebbetzin Rivka Blau, Dr. Rivka Blau. She was the Shadchanit for my sister many, many years ago. So she talks from good experience, and I thank you very much. That marriage is still intact. Yeah, flourishing, and thank you very, very much. And going back even further, one of my childhood memories, WEVD, was listening to the late lamented Rav Pinchas Mordechai Teitz, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, who was, I think, the pioneer of learning on radio. I don't know, but he didn't go beyond New York City, right? Tapes, yeah. But I heard him on the spot in New York. It was Motzoi Shabbos, right? Yeah. I was just testing my memory. But those early childhood memories of a great sage who basically brought Torah learning into the media. You know, you have a lot of people doing it today, but Rabbi Tzvi Zatzal was, I think, the first one who actually did it and did it on a regular basis. Great to be here this afternoon to talk about this topic, some of the issues that were raised by Dr. Blau are issues of, you know, how do you get the horse to the water? And then the question is, once you get them there, how do you make sure that they're working very well afterwards? And there is a feedback mechanism, unfortunately. The more we hear about marriages that break up, the more we get scared about getting into marriage in the first place. I know that in yeshiva, one of the first things that happened is that the Rebbe came in and said, you know, that tractate Gittin comes before tractate Kiddushin, that the laws of divorce come before the laws of marriage. And, you know, they have all sorts of crazy and sometimes silly jokes about this, but essentially what this does is to tell you that to understand the gravity of marriage, you have to understand the gravity of divorce. And once you do that, you understand more how serious marriage is, how sacred of an institution it is. There was a wit who once said that bigamy is when you have one spouse too many, and sometimes monogamy is the exact same thing. And our task for this afternoon in the limited time will be to try to enhance marriages, because there are many marriages that endure. That is to say, maybe they're too lazy to get divorced. It's too complicated. There are legal implications. You name it. There's so many reasons why, for the sake of the kids, which is some very often one of the worst reasons. And so people stay together, not necessarily because they're happy, but because they're afraid of the alternative. And that's not an ideal marriage. And what Dr. Blau talked about in terms of the high rate of Jewish divorce, it goes back not only to the past generation. I remember having the same sense of shock on a study of a Jewish community going back to the 13th century, where they actually showed that there was a divorce in every single one of the families in that small little hamlet. And the idea still had, we have still this mythical idea that the Jewish family is a solid family, in spite of the fact that we have such a high rate of divorce. And you wonder how this is, I don't know who was the press agent who got this done, because it would seem to be that if in fact our divorce rates are so high, then how come the marriages are so good? Well, in a sense, and I hate saying this, and please forgive me if it gives you the wrong impression, the one may actually feed into the other. Because if in fact you're getting divorced because you're unhappy, and I'm not recommending anything here, I'm just saying a fact. If in fact that's the reason why you're doing so, then obviously happiness is for you something that is very important. You want to be happy. For whatever reason it is, and let's assume that you've tried as hard as you could to stick in the marriage that you're in, it didn't work. Thank God in Judaism, as we've had from many sages, we don't press people to stay in situations which are very difficult for them, which are impossible. So you have the option out of goodbye so that you can say hello to someone else, right? So it turns out, therefore, that if you learn the lesson of the failure, if in fact there's no way out from that failure, so that the next one can be successful, it can very well be that the high rate of divorce and the strength of the Jewish family are not necessarily so much diametrically opposed. But I know I can get into a big quagmire if I go too deep into that, because I think that the desired ideal would be not that you try it, and if it doesn't work, try another one, but rather to try to make it work in the first place. There is no question in my mind that the idea of shiduchim is absolutely crucial to having marriage work. Not that it is absolutely without exception, but the general model, and by the way, if you take a look at some people, they look at the Jewish situation, they say, you know what? What can we take from this in order to make it work? And invariably, one of the things comes up is, let's have a variation on the shidduch model. And one of the things that they suggest is, and this is almost like anathema for modern generation kids, not talking about religious ones, that the parents, believe it or not, this is a big revelation, parents should be involved in the decision of who kids go out with. Because in our generation, that's one of the worst things you could ever suggest. Because children think the parents are totally out of it, and they have nothing to say, and the last thing in the world that we think of is to get the approval of the parents. But you find among sociologists that are looking at the terrible rate of marital success, that is to say, it hovers around 50%, they're saying, you know what, maybe it's not a bad idea that parents get back involved. In other words, they're in fact coming back to the shidduch model. We are having somewhat of a difficulty with it, but it's interesting to know what's going on out there, because we, in a certain sense, are the envy of the world at large. Now, Dr. Blau mentioned two shidduch models, which I want to use now as marriage models. One of them was the famous camel story, and the other one was the well story. You know, the one was with Eliezer finding a mate for Yitzchak. The other one was Yaakov on his own. So now let's go a little bit further. Just as an aside, by the way, you will notice that every single marriage, at least in Bereshis and probably going a little bit into Shemos, the ones that we have, they had invariably some sense of conflict. Adam and Chava, everybody, you know, she's the one to blame for my failings. That wasn't a healthy relationship, at least in that sense. And by the way, later on when Cain kills Hevel and God says, where's your brother? What's happened? He says, me? He says, am I my brother's keeper? In other words, I'm not responsible. Where'd he get that from? Not getting a deep analysis. But you know what happens when everybody, if you're pointing the finger at someone else and this is the way you're going about in life, that's a very dangerous way to behave. It's terrible for marriage if you keep on blaming the other one for whatever's going wrong. But Eliezer, when he went, he was playing Russian roulette, even though there was no Russia then and there probably was no roulette, with the future of his boss's son. So he went ahead and he said, the one who says, not only I'll give to you, but I'll also give to my camel, this is the one. The irony is that what he apprehended was brilliant. That one of the most important ingredients in a marriage working is kindness. If you start off with two people who are kind, you're right away into positive territory. This does not mean that kindness guarantees that the marriage is going to succeed. But if there's any ingredient that you need for the marriage to succeed, that's it. Given everything else, like the fact you're coming from backgrounds which are not antithetical to each other, which do not clash with each other, the idea of kindness, which means going the extra mile for each other, going out of the way to help each other, having a kind word for each other, the simple things. I was reminded by it a little while ago. I admit one of the things that I read is Reader's Digest. It's one of the sins of the rabbinate is we have very little time. And sometimes, I mean, this is great for that room in which you can't study Torah. So I have the Reader's Digest, and they sometimes have pretty good stuff. Condensed articles. So it was a study that was done of marriage, and it had this big headline there. So you know how you want to enhance your marriage. Simple little thing. Go out of your way to say kind things to your spouse. As what they did was a study of marriages that were really thriving. They found that that was a common denominator. So you look back at it, and Eliezer knew this long before the Reader's Digest. What he said, simply speaking, is, my parameters are, if I ask for something, and I'm given not only what I ask for, but the person says, you know what, if he's asking me for water, that means that the camel doesn't have water either. Because usually they go hand in hand, or whatever, he may have made an assumption that probably would have made sure that the camel didn't die on him, so he would have given them water. It's like saying, you know, if you have only a little bit of gas, you're going to give it to your car so you can take you where you have to go. Although gas is not something that you drink. So Eliezer said, if somebody goes out of the way and says, not only I'll grant you what you ask, but I'll see beyond the request the larger picture, and I'll react to it accordingly, and I'll do it with kindness and with eagerness to please, who would want anything better for a spouse than that? So that was to a very large measure, a brilliant stroke of genius as to choosing a wife. This is, again, given the fact that he was working within the context of Avram's instructions, which within the mishpacha, right? I strongly believe, and you may question this me on this later on, that if you gauge all of the marriages in Bereishis, that the one between Yitzchak and Rivka was the best. I know that you're going to have questions about that, but I will stand my ground on all questions on this, although it's probably hard to measure, but just based on the reporting in the Torah itself and the Chazal, I think, as you say, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that there was, but it, watch, the parameters were marvelous, the ones that were set up by Eliezer. Now take a look at Yitzchak and Rivka. Now, Dr. Blau mentioned something, a very fascinating pasuk, where the Torah says that that Yaakov loved Rivka so much that when Laban said, okay, you got to work for her for 7 years, and the 7 years was for him, ki yomim achodim. It was like a few days. Now, we know, as the Maggid of Dubno makes this observation, that if you really want something very much, so a few days seemed like a few years. So here we have this reverse mathematics. The 7 years seemed like a few days, but if he really loved Rivka so, Rachel so intensely, the 7 years should have been like an eternity. So how does that manifest this true love? So of course you can get into the psychological explanations that if you're really desperate for it, this is really not love, this is infatuation. Fine. But One interesting aspect of all of this is another ingredient that makes marriage click. And this is as follows. What did Yaakov see? This is a little bit of homiletics. What did Yaakov see? He saw in Rachel a partner for life. Not a partner for the moment. He saw in her a partner for life. For Yaakov, there was this big picture, which was the larger destiny that he saw unfolding with Rivka. So he said, in the context of a full life together, 7 years is like nothing. And it is this ingredient that we need to introduce as a fundamental component of marriage. That is to say, you're not just getting married to share a moment. You're not just getting married to share a life. You're getting married to share a destiny. Theodor Reich, a long time ago, mentioned that Jewish families can be happy or fulfilled even though they're not in love. The husband and wife are not in love in the classical sense. Because what carries them along is the fact that they're committed to being part of the building blocks of a Jewish future. You have expression of this in an interesting observation made by Viktor Frankl, who I quoted this morning. It is true that for marriage to work, essentially, one of the primary ingredients is self-transcendence. Just like to have a meaningful life, you can't be in it with the notion of self-realization, because self-realization is self-defeating. The more you're going after realizing yourself, the more it's going to elude you. But if you're out there in a self-transcendent mode, the self-realization will come on its own automatically, hopefully. So what makes marriage click is this mutual transcendence towards each other, where your fundamental penchant and your focus is not on me, but on my spouse. And what you do is an expression of kindness towards, concern about, and all this. This is a critical moment which defines marriage, where you graduate from me to we. This is critical. But then he goes on to say something quite fascinating. He says, even this mutual transcendence towards each other is not sufficient for the marriage really to work. There has to be a mutual transcendence of both of them towards the world of meaning out there. And this comes from an individual who is venerated today in many circles as a wise individual. What he said, simply speaking, was a redefinition, not that he intended it so, of the way that Yaakov and Rachel interacted. This was a destiny that they were becoming embraced in together. And those two, by the way, those two ingredients are absolutely crucial for a marriage. What do you have today, by the way, is a situation where this idea, at least in the secular world, and even I would say to a large extent in the Jewish world, where the idea of shared destiny is very foreign. The idea that we're in it together, that we can surmount problems of the immediate moment if we keep our focus on the things beyond and put it into perspective. I don't know that it's there as much as it should be, even though this is what we teach our children in yeshiva. I'm not sure it's there. You take a look at every single marriage in Bereishis, and every one of them had challenges. And that's one of the things we can take out of it. I am not suggesting that they weren't happy marriages. The Torah points out conflicts between Adam and Chava. The Torah points out conflicts between Avraham and Sarah, which were serious marriage problems, very, very, very serious marriage problems. The Torah points out serious problems between Yaakov and Rachel, to the point of castigation of Yaakov for what was perceived to be insensitivity towards her. You have, in every single situation, Leah felt herself to be the outcast in the marriage. So where was their happiness? Were they all unhappy? No. The answer is very simple. They all had challenges, and they endured those challenges, and they were happy in spite of, or maybe even because of, the challenges. The fact of the matter is that these marriages did not end in divorce. These marriages continued, because they were in this saying, you know what? We do have difficulties, but we'll get over them. A little while ago, Psychology Today had a polling of 350 couples that had been married for 25 years or more. They use that as the definition of what is a happy marriage. Because it's very hard, there's no Richter scale that marriage that does this accurately. So yeah, basically 25 years. By that I think the ex-president of the United States would have qualified, he would have been in the statistics. So you see that there's difficulties with it, but you know, on average it probably works out well. So they gave them, they separated the husbands from the wives, and they gave them a whole list of things. A list of variables, say, choose from here why your marriage has endured for all these years. And the fascinating thing, two things were fascinating. Number one, sex didn't make it into the top 10 on either the husband or the wife's side. That was interesting thing number one. Interesting thing number two was they both men and women agreed on the number one reason why they stayed together and why the marriage is endured. And you wouldn't believe what it was. It wasn't that they were both financially secure. It wasn't that they both liked the same movies. It wasn't that they both enjoyed the same sports activities. It wasn't that they both liked to exercise together. It wasn't that they both liked the same types of food. None of the above. You know what it was? A simple little intangible ingredient. They both went into the marriage with the full intention to stay in it forever, no matter what happens. Simple. Simple little thing. Do we do that? In our society, people are actually going into marriage, if they are, with the idea that if it doesn't work out, there's always other options. We have now a new thing called serial monogamy, which is to say you have one at a time, but, you know, so if this one doesn't work out, you take another one. It's almost like legalizing the idea of a multitude of spouses. And the idea that if we go into marriage with this as our background, that means that if a problem comes up, my context for solving the problem is not, come what may, we're in this together, we're going to work it out together, and it therefore will get worked out together. Of course, there are exceptions. But it is, okay, so if we can't manage, goodbye, Charlie. Or goodbye, Charlene. This is the way that it goes. So the point, very simple thing. When you're in it together, in other words, you're going in sharing a destiny. You can't share a destiny when that destiny can be only for 2 days or 3 days. You have to go in. There's a long haul. There are going to be difficulties. Look at the Avos and the Imahos. They had difficulties too, but they stuck it out together. I want to leave some time for, I think we want to leave time for questions. So let me just make a few other points. There's a question of prioritizing. When you are in marriage, you have to show that your spouse is the most important thing, is the most important person in your life, and that you don't take the spouse for granted. The model that we should be using for good marriage is a very famous posuk in the Torah, V'yahavta l'reyacha kamocha, which technically means love that which accrues to your fellow as if it is your own. But in the more prosaic sense, it says, love your Rea like you love yourself. And I have often spoken about this, that, you know, the Rea is referred to in Sheva Brachos, Sameach Tesamach Re'im U'Ahuvim. That when the Torah says this, and there's more than ample evidence for the fact that V'yahavta l'reyacha kamocha is talking about your spouse. And when the Torah says, therefore, love your spouse like you love yourself, we're not talking about some ideal out there that is impossible to fulfill. We're talking about something which is right there immediately. Look in the Gemara and you say, what is the basis for such things as the prohibition against marrying before you actually know to some extent who it is that you're marrying? The Torah says, based on the V'yahavta l'reyacha kamocha. Even in some of the Mefarshim, like Evan Ezra, as you see in the Torah, you'll see that there's a direct correlation where there's an understanding that V'yahavta l'reyacha kamocha is referring to your spouse. So what we want to sort of create is a model in terms of marriage is think of this kamocha model. Think of the fact that when you're getting married, this is now a union in which two people are fusing together into one. Not that they're losing their identity, God forbid, that would be a sin in North America to even suggest this, but that the idea that their identities are interspersed, immersed with each other, one's success is the other's success, one's failure is the other's failure, that they are tuned into each other, that each one goes out of the way to enhance the other. If you take a look in the Rambam, in Hilchos Deos, there's a lovely understanding of what V'yahavta l'rayacha kamocha means. It's not a very expensive thing. It's going out of your way and complimenting people, saying nice things to them. You know that every morning if you go out and before you leave, you say to your mom who has just prepared your lunch, thank you very much for the lunch, it was delicious. Or if you express a gratitude for anything, or if you give a compliment, this is V'yahavta l'rayacha kamocha. Building up the sense of being appreciated by the other. And if we do that in marriage, I guarantee you that all of the problems that arise, and there are many complicated things in marriage that arise, our major task this afternoon is just to create a nice framework in which these, all these problems can be tackled. Because if you do not have the goodwill, and you do not have a sense of you being appreciated, then every single minor problem becomes a medium-sized or a major problem. But if you do have that right framework, then even major problems become minor ones or even very insignificant ones. And very often you'll see, you can have two couples both having the same exact problem where in one situation, either the husband or the wife is the mavater or the mavateret and says, you know, not a problem. Why are they so giving? Because they say, you know what, in the larger picture, I have a lovely relationship. I love my spouse dearly. So what do I care about this little thing, this little blip? It means nothing. In the big picture, that's great. But if you don't have that big picture of good, so every little single problem is, why should I do this if I don't have anything else? And we lose sight of the fact that some of the time when we're dealing with marital problems, we're not dealing, you know, the isolation issues are not the problem. The problem is the entire context of the relationship. I also want to make a pitch for, as much as it is important before couples get married to learn the laws of marital separation, that they also have to learn the laws of marital togetherness. There's as much a need to learn Hilchos Ono as there is to learn Hilchos Nida. There's as much of a need to learn how to behave with affection towards one's spouse as there is a need to learn about what to do at the time that it comes to separation. The laws of Nida are well known, or at least this is well entrenched, this is something you have to study. But the laws of affection, even affection in the Nida state, which is absolutely essential. It's a criminal thing in marriage to think, okay, now that I can't touch my wife, I therefore shouldn't talk to her. Or I shouldn't have anything to do with her. It is poison. Any wife who is worth her salt will think, you know what? I'm only a person when I'm sexually available. That's to a large extent, if you ask me, it's a form of legalized prostitution. It's not the way it should be. Never was intended to be that way. What was intended was an appreciation which is 24 hours a day, nonstop, every single day of the week and every single week of the month and every single month of the year. There is no cycle of connectedness. There's a cycle which maybe creates variations in the physical connection, but not in the emotional connection. That has to be there at all times. And the idea that we should focus in on this and to make this a shall we say, a sacred component of everything that is taught before getting married, to appreciate as sacred one's spouse, to love and embrace them, to understand them at all times, and to even understand that the whole idea of separation was intended only to engender a greater togetherness afterwards. This is a basic Talmud. The Talmud asks the question, which is a very interesting question. The Gemara, it's in the context of all others, but it says, why did the Torah say that the husband has to separate from the wife? And there's a philosophical underpinning to it, which is, what kind of business is this? You're telling people to get married and to unite, and then you're telling them to separate. Hold it a minute. Make up your mind. So the Gemara says very clearly, the separation was intended only to engender a greater togetherness afterwards, to make sure that the marriage is not routinized, to make sure that the sexual relationship is one which is sacred, which is holy. And I'd like to leave you with just this lovely model, which comes from the holy letter, Igeres HaKodesh, which is attributed to the Ramban. You know, in days gone by, when people wanted to have credibility given to their books, we don't know exactly whether it was the Ramban who wrote this, but in those days, if you wanted to have credibility, you didn't say it was me. You tried to get somebody else to be the author who was more credible than you. Ego identity didn't matter so much. You wanted to get the message across. So even if this may have been not so, but there's a lovely message in this. The fact that you want other people to get the credit for it, so at least it will be read, even though it doesn't look on your, you can't even put it on your resume as a book that you have written, because you can't give away the secret. So what does he say? That one of the reasons why an onat talmid chacham is me'erev Shabbat, erev Shabbos le'erev Shabbos, that why it is that the appointed time for conjugal union, the ideal time among sages is Friday night. He says because Friday, Shabbos is Kodesh, is sacred, and the most sacred of all human expressions is the conjugal union between husband and wife. Remember this. The most sacred. And therefore, he says, on Shabbos, you have sacred meeting sacred. Sacred expression in sacred time. What better shidduch can you have than that? And that's the type of idea that permeates Jewish writing about our understanding of the beauty of the marital union. We can all aspire to the sanctity of the union. But you know what it means when you sanctify something? You ennoble it. You make it vital. You don't abuse it. And there are priorities. Who is responsible? Because the husband is the one who's most likely to abuse, the responsibility rests upon him to be the primary, but not the only, generator of shalom bayis. So I always start off marital counseling, although some of my friends in counseling may not like this, but on a religious basis, I start with the bayis. And that is, bayis, by the way, in Hebrew means the house, right? So I have a bayis for the bayis, and that is that the husband has to show just cause as to why he's not living up to his primary responsibility. Because in the end, when the Torah says, She'irach ksusava onasa lo yigra, which is the basis for the marital union and its legal obligations, that's addressed to the man, not to the woman. Not that she has to be party to it in cooperative way, but ultimately it falls on his shoulders. So if there's a breakdown there, the blame in terms of where the things may go wrong lies not necessarily only there, but certainly there's a greater responsibility. These are just some general considerations which I hope will help in terms of escalating marriage from something that is just surviving into something that is thriving. Thank you.
Okay. The microphone that's provided. Thank you. And indicate whom you asked your question to.
You mentioned about all the obvious conflicts, but you didn't mention the conflict between Yitzchak and Esav.
Well, I have a long theory about that, but I don't know what to bore you about it. But I think that this is actually, Rabbi Blau might not, I'm sorry. 6 inches, you're right. Rabbi Blau might not like this, but I have a strong feeling that Rivka and Yitzchak were perfectly in sync on what was happening. Because firstly, you have to go back to the beginning, how they were praying together. And later on, I think the conflict you're talking about is with Yaakov and Esau, right? Where Rivka says, Olai kila loscho b'ni, whatever happens, I'll take upon myself the curse. There are so many problems with it in terms of how does Yitzchak come and say, Hakol kol Yaakov, Yedayim yedei Esau, when in fact, we know that blind people have greater sensory perception, you know. So I have this theory, which you may not like, which is that Yitzchak and Rivka were working in cahoots on this. That they knew that the only way that they could make sure that Esav didn't go around and kill indiscriminately was by making Yaakov the fall guy and then sending him away packing. This was something that he worked out, and everything was working in terms of the timing. As soon as Esav left, Yaakov came in, and everything was timed perfectly. I have a strong feeling that Yitzchak and Rivka were perfectly in sync with each other, and they fooled everybody, including us. But aside from everything else, even in the end, let us say that that was a difficulty. It wasn't a difficulty in terms of them both together. It was a difficulty with regard to the children. And in the end, Yitzchak, what does Yitzchak say? Gam Baruch Yihyeh. So even if I take the other view, which I'm not convinced of, at the end he realized that his wife was right, which is a strong indication of a good marriage. Right?
Incorporate a program of communication skills, body language, how to recognize when somebody says something but means something else. If our children were, if it was inculcated, finding the appropriate parshiyot to find this in, if we could write a program to deliver to the day schools and start giving them ammunition from the beginning, not after the fact. I once asked this of Rabbi Twersky, at a Homilac weekend with Rabbi Wein, he said, yes, that the Rosh Yeshivas are never going to listen to you because it's maybe Bittelsmann. But I think that the time is now. The time is now.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
You want to ask you to ask about the guest?
Just take the microphone.
Take the microphone.
So I have the feeling that it is related to what this lady said. So pointing out what I also feel is lacking. Interestingly enough, Dr. Burka, people who stay in the marriage are those who are from the beginning thinking that they are committed to the marriage. They are interested, both of them are interested in continuing the marriage. We live in a society in which divorce is endemic because people have so many means and ways to go out of things. So it would be of great help if you could think of ways, as the Goyim thought about meditation, by which people will learn to focus and concentrate and get into things, not out of things. And with the model of, one point, finish, the second point. With the model you named, the model of Eliezer and Yitzchak, well, interestingly enough, Eliezer wanted to check if she was a giving person. She was enormously giving. It's the nature of women being givers.
Yeah.
So it would be of help if you can organize something and treat men's issues in which you can teach also men to be giving. I understand that the Kodesh Baruch Hu intervened very much in the marriage of Abraham and Sarah. I don't know how much he intervened in the other marriages.
Yeah.
In the other marriages.
If we all had the help that Abraham and Sarah had, we'd be in good shape. Hashem could.
To point it out what I feel is lacking.
Yeah. There's a book that my husband is asked to review right now called Ish V'Isha, and it's by, who's it by? Rav Kanael. A Rav in Israel has written just that kind of book for men to talk to them about how to relate to a woman and how to, and interesting, my husband was asked to review to see if it should be translated into English, and he was looking at the halacha in it because there's a discussion of halacha and then a discussion of relationships in each chapter. But I opened to one chapter and I was so struck by the fact that one of the people he's quoting is Deborah Tannen on how men speak and how women speak. And so this may not be a halachic source, but this is a very interesting rabbi quoting Deborah Tannen on how people should speak to each other. I think that both of you are absolutely right, that we have to teach young people ways of relating to each other. I don't know if it's going to be a course. I don't know if it's going to be the translation into English of this book. But there's no question that there's a lot to be learned. This has to do with the community also, though. For some reason, fun and enjoyment have been taken out of the whole dating process. It's just been made into a very earnest, you're searching for a husband, I'm searching for a wife, and we better get this over with as fast as we can. That's not a healthy way to date, and it's not a healthy way to look at life. And it's kind of scary that young people see it, either I rush into marriage to avoid getting stuck, and then I feel that I was cut off from all growth because I entered the marriage too young, or they feel I may have passed my peak at 22, and that's it. Now it's all downhill after this. Yes, we do have to teach people how to relate to each other, even on the date. My husband and I just now heard from a young woman who said that she has had the experience twice in the past few months of a young man taking her to the subway station and leaving her there to get home by herself instead of taking her home. Now, where did anybody learn about quote habrios or about how people should interact with each other that a young woman is left at a subway station at the end of a date? And I must tell you, she's a lovely young woman. It's not that anybody had such a terrible time with her that they had to say, I just have to part as fast as I can. Obviously, there's a great deal to learn, but it also has to do with the community restoring the fact that this can be an enjoyable period of life.
I also wanted to, while she was speaking, one thing that came to mind, you know, you had spoken about all of the ideas to break the barriers. Would you be against this idea of going back to the Gemara times when it said that Yom Kippur? Oh, yeah, Tu B'Av and Yom Kippur. I think that if all rabbis got together and said, you know what, instead of, we'll have a break in the afternoon. That's what they did on Yom Kippur, that girls and boys met in the afternoon. That's a sacred endeavor. You know, we have got so far away from this. Like, are you crazy? You're going to compromise the dignity of Yom Kippur by doing this? But in Talmudic times, that's what Yom Kippur was about. You weren't in shul davening all day. We set up a special time in the afternoon for guys, and this is something that rabbis can do, and we have a Talmudic basis for it, but it's not going to happen tomorrow.
No. I have time for one last question. No, we have no time. Sorry. Next session.
Please come forward just for 1 second. We have a very important announcement. Right in tune. Just for 1 second.
Okay. This leads on what we've just been talking about, the opportunity for singles to meet. We are having an event, Motzei Shabbos, November the 8th at Shomer Shabbos. It's for the under 35-year-olds. Ira Pomensky will be the guest speaker. I don't know if anyone's heard him speak, but he's very humorous, and he's going to be talking about all kinds of interesting things. So I hope that any singles who are here will come and bring their friends with them. And again, it's November the 8th at 8 o'clock at Shomer Shabbos. Thank you.